I'll begin today with a question. The question is, why do you obey God's laws? Why do you obey God's laws? And you ask different people that who are in a mode of obedience to God, and you might get a number of different answers. But one answer might be, because God says so. Yeah, certainly that's a reason to obey God's laws, because God says to obey them. But you know, that sounds like a little bit like what I was talking about in my last sermon in terms of some of the stages of growth. Sounds a lot like it might be an answer someone would give who was in that stage of growth that I referred to as blind obedience, if that's your mentality. It's been a little more than a month ago since I gave my last sermon, and I talked about four stages of growth. The first stage being lawlessness and anarchy, which kind of describes most people before they're called by God. And then the second stage, blind obedience, at the point where, okay, you understand you'd obey God's law, but you haven't seen the depth of understanding of what it really means. It's more the letter of the law. God says do it. I don't know why he says do this, but I'm doing it because he says so. That kind of way that you often, people new to the church, are focused on more in that mode. But then as they read and study and hear sermons, they move into a third stage of growth, which called informed acquiescence, where they begin to understand more than just the letter of the law, but some of the spirit of the law. And they say, okay, I'm beginning to understand this. I see what you're saying, and I will agree to this. I'm informed now. I understand, and I'm going to keep on this path. And then the fourth stage that I listed last time was value-based living, where you step beyond just being informed and acquiesced. You know, I'd say the ancient Israelites fell into that category. They were informed, they agreed to the old covenant, but they never stepped up to the level of, or not many of them did, to the level of value-based living. And so I talked about those four things, and I want to kind of talk about some of that today, but focus a little bit more on this question of the law. Why do you obey the law? And like I said, some people might just say, the answer might be God, because God says so. Others might say, because I want the blessings that go with obedience. Yeah, I agree with that. I like the blessings that go with obedience. That's a good reason to obey the law. Or on the other hand, you might say, well, I don't want the cursings that go with disobedience. But either one of these answers kind of sound like you're in the realm of growth of informed acquiescence. Saying, yeah, I understand the deal. I obey, I'm blessed, I disobey, I'm cursed. I understand the deal, and I'll accept that deal. That's a pretty good deal, and I'll accept it. So those answers might place you in that category of thinking. Or you might say, well, what I really want is eternal life and to be in God's kingdom. So that's why I obey God's laws. But again, that kind of sounds like informed acquiescence. Okay, the deal is you obey, you can be in my family. What a deal. What a deal. You know, thinking in terms of those terms. And like I said, last time I talked about moving towards value-based living. I think most people in the church maybe go through a stage of blind obedience as they come to really begin to understand the depth of what God is talking about and His plan and so forth, and move into a stage of informed acquiescence where they're basically doing the physical things that God says do, and has some spiritual understanding of the meaning behind that, and then moving into value-based living where the letter of the law itself is kind of, yeah, that's just a given, but you're moving beyond to looking at the values that all of God's laws really express. and moving up to, you might say, a different level. And that value-based living is a lifelong growth process. Now, the laws of God define, you might say, the what we're supposed to be doing. But how is a little bit different. How do you really move through the stages of growth and get to this point where you're living by God's values, not just by the law itself, but by the values expressed by that law? How do you do that? How do you make the different? You know, we come to points in our life where we have to make difficult decisions. And so you think, what does God want me to do in this situation? Boy, I'm not sure what applies, what doesn't apply, and that sort of thing. Now, if you've ever been involved in any kind of ethics, morality class in school or something like that, one of the things that they like to pose in classes like that are moral or ethical dilemmas. And these are kind of stories that seem to have no answer morally or ethically. No matter what you do, you fail, kind of thing. And so they're very contrived. They're the kind of things that rarely would anyone ever confront one of those situations, but they're designed to make you think about ethics and morality. And I want to just give you a couple of them here. And the first one is relates to the, we might call it the Robin Hood bank robber. And here's the situation. You witnessed a bank robbery with no other witnesses. You recognize the robber and learn that he has donated all the money to a very poor children's orphanage. If you turn him in, the orphanage will likely lose all that money. The children will suffer. Should you turn him in? All right, that's a kind of a moral dilemma kind of question. I'll let you mull over that one during the course of the sermon, and I'll get back to it at the end. But let me give you another one. This one's even a little more difficult, you might say, to contemplate, but it actually happened, and that's the overcrowded lifeboat. That happened. The ship, the William Brown, hit an iceberg and sunk back in 1841, and one of the lifeboats was very overcrowded. And so the dilemma, the moral dilemma is this. You're on this lifeboat in the North Atlantic. It's incredibly overcrowded. It's so overcrowded that it's just in calm waters, waves are kind of splashing over the edges and you're bailing and that sort of thing just to keep it afloat. And you're in charge of this lifeboat and there's a rainstorm coming towards you that you can see off in the distance. And you as an established sailor know that there's no way that lifeboat is going to stay afloat once that little storm gets to you. And so you, as in charge of the boat, have the dilemma, well, what do I do? We're all going to die if we all stay in the boat. So should I force some people out of the boat? As head of the lifeboat, you have some people there, some other seamen that will support whatever decision you make. Should I throw some of the people out of the lifeboat, which means they'll die in a few minutes in that cold water? Or should stay where we are, the storm's going to come, this boat is going to sink, and we're all going to die? So that's the moral or ethical dilemma here. What do you do? Do you let everybody die by inaction, or do you take some action that kills a portion of the people that were in that lifeboat? Okay, you can mull about that one too while I get into the sermon, and again, I'll come back to those. But, you know, I asked the question about why do you obey God's laws? And we can ask the question, why has God even given us laws? why has God given us laws? Why not just say one law? One two-word law should do it, shouldn't it? Do good. That covers a lot of ground, doesn't it? Why not just have a couple of simple laws like do good, love God? Kind of leave it at that. You know, why do we have the laws the way we do? Is it just obeying the law? Or is it how we fulfill these laws that is important to God? You know, just what is the role of God's laws in the life of a Christian? And that's the title of my sermon, The Role of God's Laws. That's what we're going to be talking about today. That kind of sounds like almost too simple here. Boy, we are getting back to basics, aren't we? Because everybody understands the basic question that I want to ask next, and that is, what is the purpose of God's laws? Now, if I ask you, what is the purpose of God's laws, and how do you support it by Scripture, probably everybody in the room would immediately say, well, the purpose of God's laws is to define sin. Sin is a transgression of the law. I'd probably turn over to 1 John 3:4, which we won't do here. But that's what 1 John says. It defines what sin is. It's a transgression of the law. It's lawlessness. And so the purpose of God's law certainly is to define sin. As Paul said, we won't turn there, and he wouldn't have known sin except for the law. And so, okay, so that's it. Well, it kind of takes care of that question. Or does it? There's another purpose for laws. And this is a little bit more complex to think about. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about it. But the other reason, and you may come up with some other reasons for laws, but I think this is one that is probably equal in importance to the purpose of God's laws to define sin, and that's this. Laws also function as proxies for the desires of God. Laws function as proxies for the desires of God. Now, what's a proxy? Now, a proxy is a representative of someone or a representative of something. Some idea, some vision, but it's a proxy is a representative. For example, back in my teaching days, we'd have faculty meetings, and there'd be issues related to conduct of the faculty and so forth, and we'd vote on various things. Somebody would make a motion, we'd vote on things and so forth. And quite often, some of the faculty members were not there. Maybe they had a class at that time and couldn't come to the meeting. Maybe they were off at some conference or something. But when that happened, they would ask some other faculty member to take their proxy. And so when we had discussion, we had a vote on something, that faculty member would say, well, I've got so-and-so's proxy. And he would cast two votes, one for himself and one as a proxy for the missing faculty member. You know, so a proxy is kind of can be a representative of someone who's not present. It can be a representation of an idea. You know, a proxy for some idea, and that's what I want to suggest to you here, that laws also function as proxies for the desires, for the vision of God. Now, let's turn over to Galatians 3 and verse 24 and look at that scripture, because Paul kind of says that here in these two verses, Galatians 3, 24 and 25. Let's turn and look at that. He says, Galatians 3:24, therefore the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. So he uses the term tutor here. But can you read this if you substituted proxy for tutor? How would this read? Therefore, the law was our proxy to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer in need of a proxy. You know, it kind of relates there. There's kind of a similar idea there of a tutor, a proxy. The idea here that the law represents something. Now, let me give you an example of what we're talking about here. Something that most everybody here is familiar with, and that is our federal progressive income tax code. Now, we're all familiar with that. It's not that far away. You're probably receiving W-2 forms and tax information already in the mail, and that April deadline will be here before you know it. Well, why do we have a progressive tax code? Why do we have bracketed income taxes? You know, the brackets start at 10% and go up to 39.5% in the current tax code. And so low income people will be in that 10% bracket, but as your income gets higher, then the higher part of your income will kick up to that next bracket, and eventually you might work your way up, if you're making a pretty decent living, up to that 39.5% bracket, which means you're paying almost 40% of at least portion of that income to the federal government. Why? Why is it that way? Who did that? And why did they do it? Why do we have the tax brackets? Why not just a flat rate? You know, some people say, man, that's what we ought to do. We ought to have a flat rate tax. Why the brackets? What's the answer to that? Why? Whose great idea was that? Well, the great idea came from our elected representatives, right? They passed a law. And they've adjusted those brackets from time to time over the years. Matter of fact, at one time, I think the highest rate was 90%. If you were very rich, the government took almost all of that money. But you might say that our elected representatives are our proxies, right? They represent us in making the laws. And so is not the bracketed income tax, progressive income tax, is that not part of what you might say is a vision of what is fair or what is right? In other words, what has happened in the development of this stepped bracketed progressive income tax? What has happened is that enough people who are representing the public got together and said, to be fair, to do the right thing, to do good, we shouldn't expect the poorest among us to pay the same percentage of income tax as the richest among us. That the rich, because they have a lot more than they need just to live, they should be paying a higher percentage of their income because it's the right thing to do. So we might say that the federal income tax law represents a vision of what is the right thing to do. Or to look at it another way, we might say the federal income tax law is a proxy for what we consider as the right thing to do. Now, suppose that the tax law was just a simple six words. Suppose the tax law, you know, the tax, big thick books on the tax law, you know, it's really complicated. You see it in the news all the time. After every election, ones that elect say, we got to simplify the tax laws. They're a mess. Doesn't seem to ever get very simplified. But what if they simplified the tax code to six words? Six words, and that is, pay what you think is fair. I see there's some skeptics among us as to how that might work. It's kind of like if only the only God, law God gave is do what's good, isn't it? That probably is not going to work out too well in a number of circumstances. Now, you know, I could take a poll and ask for a show of hands, I won't, and ask you, how fair do you think the federal income tax code is? And some of you would say, yeah, it's reasonably fair, I think. Some of you say, no, it's not fair. And you'd have different opinions of what is fair. But the bottom line is that the tax code is a proxy to express fairness in the way that we pay for the cost of our government. It's a proxy. And all laws basically function like that because they're not just God's laws, but, you know, laws in state, federal, and so forth. They function, they're proxies to represent an idea or a vision of often what is fair, what is right, or what is good, that sort of thing. Now, let's get back to religion here. We don't want to spend too long on income taxes, or everybody will go out crying. But let's get back to religion and talk about income taxes as it relates to religion. The tithe. We could view that as a tax. Now, God has given that to us as the law, right? He talks about tithes and offerings and say we should give 10% of our increase back to God. Now, what is the vision behind that law? Well, the vision is two things. First, that congregations of God's people need support in various ways, in terms of ministers, in terms of halls, in terms of costs related to the feast. Things like that need support, need financial support. And so that's part of where that tithe goes. And the other part of the vision is we need to preach the gospel to the world. And so it's like a two-part vision that the tithe law is expressing a vision of taking care of the congregations and preaching the gospel. That's the vision. And so God has set up law. Now, it's not progressive. Everybody pays 10%. It doesn't mean some people don't pay more than others. You know, you're making $10 an hour, you're paying a dollar. You're making $100 an hour, you're paying $10 for that hour. So you do pay more as you make more, but it's not progressive. You know, you don't pay $40 out of that $100 because you're in a higher tax bracket. All right, so it's not progressive. But notice that God has put a little catch, you might say, into the whole process. Because he says, come to me with your tithes and offerings. And he doesn't tell you how much offering to give. He says, don't come before me empty. He says, bring your tithes and offerings. And of course, we take up offerings on the holy days. But what is the role of the offering? You know, the offering leaves room for you to make a judgment on what is fair. Does it not? You know, I said, how would it work if God just said, or the government just said, pay what is fair? In one sense, God is saying that your offering, give what is fair for you. Not what is fair for somebody else, but give what is fair for you. Now, so that part of our giving is all judgment. Now, you know, your offering is a judgment of what is fair from your own perspective. not from anybody else's. For example, you may have had a really good year. You worked a lot of overtime. You've been blessed. And that's what God says, according to how you've been blessed, give. And so you give a really nice offering because you've been blessed financially. On the other hand, probably in most of our lives, there have been times when, you have a job, but you have problems, and you can't give much of an offering, but still give something. You know, so you're making a judgment, a value-based judgment, on what is fair to give to God, according to how you've been blessed. Now, it's a judgment thing. It's a value-based judgment. When you think about it, you know that there's that 10% floor. The law says tithe 10%. That's the floor. A lot of people think of it as the ceiling, but that's the floor. And now you're asked to make a judgment of how much more I'm going to give than that minimum. It's a judgment thing, and it's based on what kind of value you're setting on God's blessing. So you give $10 of an offering, you're saying, boy, that's how much God's blessed me this time, $10. That's it. Or you give $500. Saying, boy, God has really blessed me. But you're making a judgment. Every time you send out a tithe and offering check, every time you make an offering at a holy day, you are making a judgment about the value of what God has done for you. You're putting a value on that. Think about it that way. It's kind of scary sometimes. Now, over the years, going back when I first came in the church back in the late 60s, whenever we had a holy day offering, they would announce the offering later on. They'd announce three things. They would announce the total offering, the number of attending, and the offering per person, the average offering per person. Remember those days? We don't do that anymore, but we used to do that. Now, those of you who remember those days, let me ask you this question. Whenever that offering per person was announced, what's the first thing that went through your mind? The very first thing that went through your mind, was I above or below the average? That's the first thing that went through my mind. I'm guilty. You know, I'm sitting there and I'm saying, let's see, I've got myself, my wife, and two kids, so I've got to take my offering, divide it by four, and did I make it? Now, the last few times I remember that we announced offering, which has been years ago, the average was like maybe $70 or something like that, as I recall. And, the average offering is $70 per person. So I'm quickly figuring, let's see, 4 times 7, 280. Boy, if I didn't give $280, I'm below average. And if I fell below average, I started thinking, man, I've got to get myself up there next time. But if I was above that, hey, I gave $300. I was above that $70. I kind of, I'm there. I'm above average. But you see the problem here. When you announce that average, it's almost like it's a law. And you think, okay, I've got to make that. I've got to make that next time if you didn't make it that time. And so your mindset is not one of, well, just how much has God blessed me? But what's the average? I've got to be at that average. And that's the wrong mindset, because we're not thinking values. And that's one of the reasons we don't announce that average anymore. We don't want you to be thinking in terms of here's the standard, because everybody else averaged out that much. You're nothing if you can't make that average. You know, we don't want you thinking like that. A swell with pride. Man, I doubled the average. What about that? Yeah, see, that kind of, that's not value-based living. And so God has left it to us individually to make the decision about the offering in terms of our judgment. Now, back when the split up of the Worldwide Church of God, after I left, for some reason they didn't take my name off the elders list for a while. And I continued to get letters and so forth that were sent to the ministry. And at one point, they announced that they were changing the tithing law and that you don't have to tithe anymore, that law was done away with. I don't remember what they said exactly. But the thing that struck me is the person, and I don't remember who was writing this at the time, but what they said was, now that the tithing law is no longer in effect, you can give more. You're not restrained to that 10%. You can give more. Now, soon after that, I was taken off the list, so I haven't followed anything about the finances of that church since. But my suspicion is that probably didn't work exactly the way they envisioned it. But it does point out something about laws. Like the tithing law, laws in general set a minimum. They set a floor. But many people look at the laws as the ceiling instead of the floor. So the tithing law sets a minimum to support the work and support the congregations. Your offerings are above that and is solely your own judgment. I don't know how often you think about that as you're planning an offering for the holy days or whatever, but you should be thinking, this is how I'm expressing to God how I've been blessed. It's a judgment. It's a value-based judgment. Now, if all you're remembering the last time that average was $70 a person, I'm going to give $70 a person, you're not thinking values. You're kind of back in a kind of a letter of the law kind of thing. Well, if everybody's giving that much on the average, I'm okay if I can do that. You know, that kind of mentality is not value-based living. You know, Christ didn't say a lot about offerings, did he? But one of the telling things that he did say was when he talked about the widow's mite. Smallest coin in the realm, and how he valued that in terms of what that poor woman was able to get, because that's all she had. That's all she had. That's what Christ is looking at. That's what God is looking at. He's looking at us making value-based judgments. And that kind of brings me to one of the main points here, and that is the flaw in all rule-based systems. There's a flaw in the law. Whatever the law is, there's a flaw. Now, let me give you another example from the world. Get it out of religion for a minute. Voting. Now, we don't generally encourage voting, but there is a law in Louisiana that you have to be 21 years, I think it's 21 years, if it hadn't changed, you have to be 21 years old to vote. That's the law. And that's the law in a lot of places across the country. All right, so we have a voting age limit. Why? What's the vision behind setting a voting age limit? What's the vision? Well, I would suggest that the vision is that to get the greatest good for the greatest number of people, only mature, civic-minded people should vote. You know, that's kind of a vision. But how do you decide who is mature and civic-minded enough to vote? There are 15-year-olds that are very mature. There are a lot of 30-year-olds that are totally immature. But how do you do that? How do you set that kind of limit to establish what is real maturity. Well, you know, under the guise of all kinds of things over this country's history, we had things like literacy tests. And that tended to be a guise for keeping blacks from voting in the South over the years. And so that didn't work. That was just supporting prejudice, not a vision of fairness. And so that was done away with, thankfully. And so the idea, okay, well, we set this age limit. We'll set a certain age limit, and anybody that exceeds that age limit can vote. And, you know, the idea here is, well, it's not maybe the best standard, but it's an efficient way to do it. And in most cases, laws tend to express efficient ways of accomplishing a vision, but not necessarily the most effective way to accomplish a vision. Now, there's one thing about efficiency, there's another thing about being effective, and they're not, it's hard to get laws that can do both over the spectrum, you might say. You know, so there is a flaw there in that, you know, you just can't get a law to cover everything and to take care of every eventuality. You know, when we rely on a set of laws, that in a way it turns to be limiting. For example, let me give you, now let's get back to religion, for example. Suppose that when you came in today, there's a big sign right there at the door, on the stand coming up from the floor, a big sign that said the following. No food or drink in the meeting room. Children under 9 must be accompanied by an adult to the restroom, and talking during services is absolutely prohibited. Then our pastor comes up and says, we had to set these laws because we were having some problems. People were spilling stuff on the floor, and the management's complained because we've had some commodes stopped up and little kids back in the bathroom. And because we have a bunch of teenagers back there just chatting away and disturbing everybody. So here are the laws. How would that strike you if you came in and saw that? As opposed to Mr. Sandilands coming up before us and describing the incidences, saying, well, we've had this problem with this, and the management's not happy because we haven't been taking care of the hall, and we've had some problems in the restroom, and there's some talking going on and things like that. And therefore, we would like to remind you and ask everyone to recognize that we are representing God when we're in this hall, and those that we need to respect God and those around us and the facilities during the service. Now, see, that's talking values. But the sign is giving laws that would cover those three things. But what about something else that might happen? Okay, I won't do those things, but I'll shoot spitballs at somebody. Because that's not against the law. You see what I'm talking about here. The laws are designed to express values, but they can't express every circumstance. They can't cover every single circumstance. Look at Hebrews 8 and verse 7. Hebrews 8 and verse 7. Paul is talking about this same subject here. Hebrews 8, 7. For if that first covenant had been faultless, then no place would have been sought for a second. Oh, the first covenant was faultless. It wasn't faultless. There was a problem there. Verse 8, because finding fault with them, referring to the ancient Israelites, he says, behold, and he quotes Jeremiah 31 here, behold, The days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Jacob, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand and led them out of the land of Egypt, because they did not continue in my covenant, and I disregarded them, says the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. So what is he saying here? Well, first of all, he's saying there was a fault. The fault was with the people because of what I was kind of just describing. Yeah, they could obey the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law, very few were able to do that. You know, there's some exceptions, like David, the prophets, and different ones. But by and large, as a nation, they couldn't stick with it very long and be in that value-based mode. Now, over in Hebrews 10, in verse 1, look at Hebrews 10, verse 1. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never, with these same sacrifices, which they offered continually, year by year, make those approach perfect. Now notice, this kind of saying the same thing I started out talking about, the law as a proxy. Here, Paul calls it a shadow. It's a shadow. The law is a shadow of what God's vision is. And by itself can never be perfect because there's so many possible things that can't be covered in any law. I mean, think about, I mentioned the income tax code a while ago. Thousands of pages long. Why? It didn't start out thousands of pages long. How did we end up with such a complex income tax law? Because somebody found a loophole. And they got around paying some taxes. Okay, we've got to amend the law, close that loophole. So that loophole was closed, somebody found a loophole over here, and that one was closed, and now we have thousands of pages of income tax law. People will find loopholes. You know, if those rules governing hall behavior here, those are the three rules, I'll find a loophole and get around some of those things. I'll text instead of talk. Yeah. See, people always look for the loopholes when they should be looking at the vision the law expresses. Now, of course, does that mean that God's laws aren't really necessary? Of course not. We know, let's look at just a couple of scriptures here briefly, just to reinforce that. Romans 7 and verse 7. Romans 7, 7. What shall I say then, Paul writes, is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law, for I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. You know, Paul is saying here, yeah, the law is an absolute necessity. It's a necessity because, one, it defines sin, as he was emphasizing here. But, two, because, as he said in Hebrews, it's a shadow of the vision of what God wants you to do and to be. Turn over to Romans 3 and verse 27. Romans 3:27. Where is boasting then? It is excluded. By what law? Of works? No, by the law of faith. Therefore we conclude that a man is justified by faith apart from the deeds of the law. What does faith mean? We're talking about trust in the values that God has set before us, that they work, right? And that God will do what he says. But continue on here in verse 29, or is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not also the God of the Gentiles? Yes, of the Gentiles also, since there is one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith. Do we then make void the law through faith? Certainly not. On the contrary, we establish the law. So it's clear that there's no idea here that we don't obey the law. But that's the beginning. Now, that's the starting point. That's the floor. Christ himself, over in Matthew 5 and verse 17, you might turn over there, Matthew 5 and verse 17, said, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For surely I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled." So Christ reinforces the idea and confirmed the validity of the law. But it's clear, as you study the Bible, that obedience to the law is simply the first stage of growth. That's the beginning point. And that's where we all started. Yeah, we got to obey the law. Man, I didn't know how to keep the Sabbath. I didn't know when the Sabbath was. You know, so now you start obeying the law, and then the vision of what the law represents builds up. And you come to more understanding, and you grow. And you move through informed acquiescence to value-based living over a period of your lifetime. And let me give you seven dangerous traps in understanding God's laws. Seven dangerous traps in understanding God's laws. Okay, number one is becoming too dependent on the letter of the law. Matthew 23 and verse 23. That famous chapter where God lays it out to the scribes, the Pharisees, calls them snakes, calls them hypocrites. "What are you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites? For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have not neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." And notice what he's saying here. You obey the law. That's the floor. But where you really need to be focusing on are such things as justice, mercy, and faith. Now, you don't find a law that simply says, "Do justice. Thou shalt do justice." But that's the value expressed by the laws. Now, so that can become a trap if you become too dependent on the law. Isn't that what the religious leaders of that time did? They kept trying to trap Christ, healing on the Sabbath, picking some grain on the Sabbath, those kind of things. They wanted to get him to trap him because he broke the law. He did something you weren't supposed to do on the Sabbath. And every time they did that, Christ started talking values back to them. Didn't it? All right, trap number two ties into what I was just saying, thinking in terms of the law as a ceiling rather than a floor. Thinking of the law as a ceiling rather than a floor. Remember the parable of the unprofitable servant? It's given over in Luke 17. You know, he's talking about the servant who goes out and works in the field and so forth, and he comes in and he doesn't sit down to eat. He serves the master before he sits. And doing that, he's an unprofitable servant. In Luke 17:10, we won't turn there, he says that that's all he does. He's an unprofitable servant because he hasn't gone above what he was hired to do, basically. And that's what happens when you start thinking in terms of the law as a ceiling rather than a floor. That's the starting point. If you just obeyed the letter of the law, you're an unprofitable servant, is what Christ was saying. Plain and simple. And unprofitable servants aren't going to be in God's kingdom. Now, trap number three is looking for loopholes in the law rather than focusing on the principles. Look at Matthew 18, verse 21. Matthew 18 and verse 21. Peter came to him and said, "Lord, how often shall we, my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times?" He's been told to forgive. Okay, can we put a number on that? Can we just put a number on that? Because it's hard enough to forgive once. Seems like to me if I forgive somebody seven times, that ought to be about right. Isn't that our thinking? Man, if I can just pay an offering that averages whatever bills, hey, that's about right. Christ answered, no, up to 70 times 7, but obviously he's not setting a new higher number. He's saying, you got to keep doing it. The value is you forgive over and over again if you have to. See, Christ talks about the value here. Peter was looking for a loophole. And that's the trap. We tend to look for loopholes to get around parts of the law we feel uncomfortable with. Whether it's God's law or man's law, we tend to do that. Trap number four. Not focusing on the fullness of the law. Look at Matthew 19:3. The Pharisees came also to him, again testing him. They were trying to trap him. And the law was the way they thought they could do it. And the Pharisees came to him, testing him, saying to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife just for any reason?" And he answered and said to them, "Have you not read..." And did he quote a law? No, he said, "Have you not read, 'He who made them in the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate.'" He's talking values here. Not quoting some law. So that's the way God made it. That's the value. A man and a woman marry, and they share a life together as if they were one. That's the value. You know, you can say, okay, here's the law, you should get married. But the value is how you build that marriage, how you build that love. See the difference there? Pharisees were thinking of laws. And verse 7, you can see what they were thinking. They said, "Well, ha, we got you now. Why did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce? Why did Moses allow divorces, huh? How about that, Christ? What do you think about that? You think you know so much? Moses, our father Moses, allowed divorces." See, they were thinking law. And then, of course, Christ had to explain this. He said, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, because you were looking at the letter of the law and you weren't thinking values. You weren't thinking values. He permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so." So he got back to values again. So not focusing on understanding the fullness of the law is a trap. That was trap number four. Number five. Laws can be viewed as either over or under inclusive. Now, because they're proxies, they cannot be precise. You know, you can cover certain things, but there's always something that comes up that the law just doesn't address. You know, and so you can tend to think, okay, well, there is. Like the Pharisees, they said, okay, we have the laws, but boy, if we come up with something, we got to make a new law. How far can you travel on the Sabbath? That's supposed to work on the Sabbath. How far can you travel? You know, so the Jews come up with a law on what's the Sabbath day's journey, the maximum you can do, you know, things like that. So they become over-inclusive or you become under-inclusive. Well, if the law doesn't cover that, I guess it's okay. So that's a trap, to see the law in that way as a line. You can be over, under inclusive instead of thinking about values. Trap number six. You know, the lack of immediate punishment can lead to disregarding laws. Now, God doesn't punish us immediately, does he? Or at least not you. Sometimes you get punished pretty immediately. But a lot of times we don't. The punishment seems to come later. And think, oh, hey, what? I can get struck by lightning. That must be okay what I did. You know, we kind of get that mentality if we're not careful. And that's a trap. Thinking the punishment is always immediate. It's not. And it's not always physical. It can be mental. And number 7, over-reliance on the letter of the law tempts us to play too close to the edge. It tempts us to play too close to the edge. You ever thought about it that way? Just how close can I get here and still not break God's law? Now, this is not exactly covered. I think I'm probably okay here, but man, this is kind of nip and tuck. Now, 7 traps that we can fall into. And what I want to get to here is to begin to wrap this up. I'm talking about value-based living here, our goal. And how we think matters. How we think matters. Not how we do so much as how we think. And this idea of can I do this or can I not do this? If we're thinking can, and over the years, I don't know how many times I've been asked by someone related to whether something is within the law, can I do this? Or the question should have been, should I do this? You know, we all think in terms of black and white, yes or no. And we should be thinking of, should we do this? Should we do this? Now, when we ask, what should I do? It opens up a wide spectrum. Look at Matthew 5 and verse 20. Matthew 5 and verse 20. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, why did Christ say that? Why didn't he say, if you don't obey the law better than the scribes and Pharisees, you're not going to make it? He didn't say that. He said, unless your righteousness exceeds what the scribes and Pharisees are doing. And boy, they could keep a law. Those guys knew how to keep the Sabbath, knew how to keep laws. They could do that, the letter of. They were pretty good at that. But righteousness was seen to be completely beyond any thought with those religious leaders of that time. You know, now, in Matthew 22, we won't turn there, Matthew 22, 36 through 40, kind of one of those memory scriptures, an individual came up and said, what is the greatest law? And Christ said, well, there are two. Love God, love fellow man. That's basically what he said. He said, everything hinges on those two laws. So he basically said, 10 commandments, first part, loving God, second part, loving your fellow man. That's it. He taught values. You know, they were hoping he'd say, oh boy, the biggest law is you don't want to murder. Or something like, you know, they were looking for, what's your top 10 laws? What's the best law? And let's go down from there. And he said, no. He talked about values. And the values of the expressed by the heart of the law, the Ten Commandments, is love. But let's be a little more specific here. Let's take the last 5 commandments, which relate specifically to your fellow man. Those last 5 commandments. What is the value expressed by each of those commandments? Let's start with number 6, which the next verse, Christ gets into that, thou shalt not murder. What is the value expressed by that commandment? What's the value that's being expressed? Well, look what he says in verse 21 of Matthew 5. You have heard it said of old, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, whoever is angry with his brother in his danger." Christ expressed a value. What was that value related to murder? Empathy, even for your enemies. He was expressing an attitude of love where you're so have such an empathy for others that murder would never even come into your mind. You know, so the value there, of course, broadly is love, but if we look more specifically, is being very empathetic with your fellow man. So you don't hate. You don't do things like that. Your mindset is not in that frame of mind that even when you're offended, even when you're harmed, you're very empathetic to other individuals. That's the value expressed by thou shalt not murder. What about thou shalt not steal? Now we look down in verse 25. Here in Matthew 5, agree with your adversary quickly while you're on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you up to the judge, and the judge hands you over to the officer, and you're thrown into prison. In other words, if you have a controversy and you're guilty, you better settle up. If you've taken something that doesn't belong to you, if you steal, you better settle up. So what are we talking about? The commandment, thou shalt not steal. What's the value that we're talking about? I mentioned it a while ago. Justice. We're talking justice. The commandment, thou shalt not steal, is expressing God's value of justice. What about thou shalt not commit adultery? Verses 27 and 28. You have heard it said to those of old, you should not commit adultery, but I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery in his heart. What does the commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, what value is God really talking about? What value is God talking about here? Is he not talking about faithfulness? Isn't that what he's talking about? Being faithful? Being faithful to your wife? And notice how he carries this analogy all through the New Testament. What's being compared to a marriage? The church portrayed as the bride of Christ. Church portrayed as the bride of Christ. Faithfulness. The value expressed by thou shalt not commit adultery is faithfulness. What about thou shalt not bear false witness? Matthew 5:33. Again, you have heard it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, swear not at all by heaven or earth, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, and so forth. He ends up saying in verse 37, but let your yes be yes, and your no be no. In other words, be what value are we talking about? What value is being expressed here by not lying? Truth and honesty. The value is truth and honesty. That's what God's saying. Be truthful, be honest. How about coveting? Thou shalt not covet. What's the value being expressed by that law? Well, we see that over in Matthew 7. You know, it's the same part of the Sermon on the Mount here, as it's so called. But in Matthew 7, verse 11, if you then, being an evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, also do to them, for this is the law and the prophets. The value of thou shalt not covet, that law, the value being expressed is generosity. Generosity to everyone around you. Generosity. See, and we need to be thinking in terms of those values, never forgetting the letter of the law. But if we're living those values, the letter of the law becomes a non-issue because you're going to be obeying all the letters of the law if you're living God's values. Let's go back to those ethical dilemmas here in conclusion. Those ethical dilemmas that I talked about in the introduction. The bank robber. Now, there was a poll taken on this question. And people were asked, would you report him or not? Under the conditions that I described at the beginning. 80% said they would not report him. 80% said they would not report him. 20% said yes, they would report him. And what about people in this 80% group that are, you know, what kind of thinking are they going through? You know, probably along the lines of, well, he did steal, but man, he gave it to these poor kids, and if I turn him in, they're going to suffer, and I can't do that. Nobody's hurt. Anyway, the bank's insured, everything's covered. What's the big deal? You know, that kind of mentality. And what would the 20% probably thinking along the lines of? Stealing is wrong. And because I know who did it and have the evidence to support it, if I don't turn him in, I'm an accomplice after the fact, so to speak. Am I not? So let's say you think along those lines and your decision is, yes, I should turn him in. Are you a profitable servant? You've obeyed the letter of the law. Turned him in. No. You're not. You're unprofitable. If that's all you do, you're an unprofitable servant. Why? Because you've done the letter of the law and not seen the value. What's going to happen to the orphanage? Do you not now have an obligation to do what you can do to help that orphanage? What could you do? Well, you might get your name in the paper because you turned in the bank robber. And you could use that as a form to say, that doesn't solve the problem that we're facing with this children's orphanage. We need to do something. Or if it was one of you, you might come here and say, we need to help that orphanage. How can we do it? Will you join me in helping? Now, you're becoming a profitable servant. See the difference? Obeying the letter of the law, the spirit of the law, the values of the law. What about the other one? The life, overcrowded lifeboat. Talk about a no-win situation. This actually happened, as I mentioned, back in 1841. There was a pretty good-sized lifeboat. It was called a longboat. 41 people ended up in that lifeboat. It could only safely hold about half of that. And one of the officers from the ship, made the decision that they would throw overboard 14 people. And they did. They threw overboard 14 people. And one of those persons was the brother of two sisters that were on the lifeboat. Those two sisters decided to throw themselves overboard with their brother. So 16 people died. But the lifeboat didn't sink during that storm. The rescue ship came by. The rest were saved. And this is a long time ago. News, community, you know, that didn't have CNN or anything like that back in those days. So by the time it got back to a port in Philadelphia, these people, the seamen on that boat, they had all dispersed and so forth. One person was finally eventually tried and convicted. He was sentenced to 6 months in jail and fined $20. But what about you? Suppose you were that individual that was in charge of that lifeboat. What would you do? Would you save the 20 or so and sacrifice 16? What would you do? Might I suggest, it's a no-win situation, isn't it? You're going to kill people no matter what you do. So you're going to break God's law. Might I suggest another alternative? What would have happened if that leader had said, this boat is going to sink and we're all going to die unless some make the sacrifice? I will do it first. And you jump into the water and sacrifice your own life, hoping that others will see the vision and enough will also make that sacrifice that some will be saved. I don't know, as I mulled this over, I didn't see any other answer that you could really, a conclusion that you could come to other than self-sacrifice as an example to the others. Isn't that what Christ said? Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. God's laws are a floor. If you meet that floor, you're an unprofitable servant. Because you haven't seen the values. You haven't caught the vision of what God has. And he's given you the tools to do that. And if that's where you are, just meeting the minimum down there on the floor, that's not going to work. That's not going to work in the long run. Do you have God's vision? Are you fulfilling God's vision as you fulfill God's laws?